The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday morning tech chat show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, and I'm still full of goop. I took last week off just to try and rest up from this head cold. I'm mostly better in terms of like not having, you know, crazy head pressure and being able to sit upright for longer periods of time. I still sound really rough. This might end up being a bit of a shorter podcast just because I've got a lot of biology happening here. And then also, I'm going to be trying to mitigate some of the throat clearings, coughing, snorting, all of that mess, just trying to keep the biology of that off the mic. So there might be times where I suddenly just... And then you're going to have to kind of read lips for where I was coming back into the chat. Yeah, I'm gonna try to manage what's going on here. But I want to jump in immediately. Steve, Q3 Becker, subscribed with Prime. They've been subscribed for 21 months. And Bawang Byte, subscribed at Tier 1. They've been subscribed for 13 months. Thank you so, so much. Supporting the channel, contributing, and coming back every week, even when I take a week off. I'm so glad to be able to jump into these conversations. I feel like I'm at like 85%. You know, I kind of made that joke on Twitter. I feel like mostly functional, a little biology. I'm going to try and not tax the voice while we chat out some fun tech and we go through some rumors. And I want to save a little time at the end of this. Like, you know, it's October. Because I didn't stream last week. I feel like this is spooky movie time, and you know, I'm super into horror and scary stories and scary movies and stuff, and we can maybe save some of that, just a little fun conversation at the end, so that we can chat out seasonal appropriate, that's the word I'm looking for, seasonally appropriate movies. Oh, and Dojen Fortor, I've mispronounced your name, subscribe to at Tier 1, and apparently there's a hype train going on, so use your bits if you feel inclined to sub. Again, apparently hype train is raring to go. I still don't know the Twitch as well as I should for these types of for these types of Twitch traditions.
So why don't we try jumping into some housekeeping? We'll get some of that out of the way, and then we'll come back and we'll actually chat out some of these news stories and everything. I'm gonna take a sip of water already. First of all, I hope everyone had a lovely weekend. E-Price 4000 subscribed with Prime, and we reached Hype Train level 2. Is that how this works? Level 1 is complete, so thank you very much. Hype Train is ongoing. Why don't we jump into some housekeeping here, while I continue to show my ignorance of the streaming platform that I choose to use. So I didn't stream last week. From last Monday to now, and then the week before, I put out a lot of stuff. So I'm just going to do a quick recap, the In Case You Missed It edition of housekeeping for this week. And there's a lot that I'm building towards. So there are a few things I can't talk about. Some of you probably already know one of the things I can't talk about. And then after housekeeping, I want to show off some of the things that I can talk about that I've just gotten that we'll be playing with. So I'm gonna go into screen share here. I had to write a cranky editorial, which I feel are some of my best editorials, praising Apple for the bare minimum, 120 hertz and better battery on the iPhone. Just as a recap of some of the commentary that I've been seeing on the iPhone 13, I'm still not buying anything Apple until we know for certain that they're not going to be building backdoors into their products. I'm continuing to hold on that line, where we hear unequivocally from Apple that they will be discontinuing that device scanning program. But a lot of people coming out to say, like, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. They gave us 120 hertz. And battery life even got better. And I appreciate that there's still this sentiment that when Apple does something, they'll do it right, not like those other companies that just experiment with features. But the only way that can be true is if the entire iPhone 12 generation was a 5G beta test, and that Apple used all of their customers as 5G lab rats. And then came to the conclusion, oh, we should probably put in bigger batteries. So I feel like Apple gets credit. I mean, yeah, the iPhone 13 battery life is phenomenal, but they didn't get the criticism of, like, all this time they could have been giving us bigger batteries. And people have been asking for this for a while. Going from the iPhone 11 to the iPhone 12 was a battery downgrade for most consumers. So, I felt like that needed to be put into text. Moving right along. Already, I'm explaining the housekeeping way too long here. We gotta move more efficiently through this. I spent a little time with the updated Panasonic ToughBook, which really feels like if RoboCop were a laptop, so the FZ55 Mark II. Always love getting to spend some time with some legit rugged gear. The other really surprising review, I got to spend some time with the Eco Zerta. So Eco, they make a bunch of really fancy in-ear monitors and headphones, and they've made some USB and Lightning connector DACs in the past. The Zerta is their refresh, and it's got a little swappable cable, and this is stunningly good audio performance, just nipping at the heels of some of the DACs that I've reviewed that are substantially more expensive. So definitely a fun find for audiophiles. Eco Zerda, Zerda. We got a review of that. And then over the last week, I've been shooting heavy on Vivo. So my first video, Vivo X70 Pro Plus versus X70 Pro, just comparing some of the differences between the two phones, but trying. Instead of just making it how the two phones are different, I really wanted to try and focus on how they were the same. And this video has elicited, like, some of the most consistent, how come you not read specs comments on any of the videos I've ever produced. Like, the whole point of this video is to try and show that despite the differences between these two phones, they feel really similar. And I would say it's probably one out of four, and I've been muting because I just feel they're useless comments. But it's been about one out of four where people are like, well, you didn't even tell us like what all of the different specs are. Like, I'm not going to make a video where I just read GSM Arena at you. I feel if you were functional enough to use a web browser or an app to find this video, you should be functional enough to just look that stuff up on your own. So, and we have completed Hype Train with strong support, with level one completed, and there is a choo-choo emote that is in the chat. So thank you very much, everybody. Oh, I miss Simon Says Hypno, also subscribed. ePrice4000, Simon Says Hypno. Thank you so much, everybody. I really appreciate it. So, sorry, getting back in because I don't want housekeeping to last forever. I also did a quick showdown talking about gimbals in smartphones, and I felt like, you know, this was the right time to bring back my LG Wing as one of the other major smartphones that incorporated some kind of advanced image stabilization. And just to show off, I mean, like, there are some interesting differences. It's not enough to say this camera has this many megapixels and that's how it works. There are reasons to maybe consider buying other phones. And gimbals are a really interesting idea to me for how people shoot, especially like family footage. You know, you're chasing after your kid at a soccer game. There might be a reason to step away from like a Samsung or an Apple if that's like something you're going to be doing on the regular. So let me get this out of the way here. And then lastly, for the site, for somegadgetguy.com, I did publish a Buy the Benchmarks. And this is not only my first time using a Vivo, this is also my first time using a Snapdragon 888 Plus, and it's my first time using a MediaTek Dimensity 1200. So this, by the benchmarks, I feel is, it's one of the more important benchmarking comparisons that I've done. Really looking at video rendering performance, audio mixdown performance, PC-style RAR compression, image stabilization, batch photo processing, things that I feel like these phones are actually kind of designed to be used for. You know, when you pick up a Vivo and you see this ridiculous of a camera bulge on the back of the phone, and there are two distinct different flavors of RAW file, and the image sensor is closing in on a 16 millimeter film frame sized image sensor, I think it's fair to say that person might be more likely to edit RAW files. You know, that's a creative individual, especially in terms of photography. So this is supposedly Qualcomm's most powerfulest processor, mostest, refinedest. This is MediaTek's most powerful chipset currently, the Dimensity 1200. And I really wanted to put these two together against some other 888s, some other 8, I put in an 870, some 865s, and an 855, the Surface Duo. So over, you know, the three generations of chipset, refined, you know, plus versions, variants, refreshes, and now this new Vivo top of the line. And I think the results are very surprising for the big claims being made. And then they also continue to reinforce just how uninformative synthetic benchmarks can be. So, I mean, on the article, obviously, I've got like a big photo close-up of the Vivo's Geekbench scores. So if you look at those Geekbench scores, they should predict which phones will work better for heavier lifting apps. And they absolutely do not predict which phones will run those apps better. So, dang it, I should have paused, I should have muted the mic right there. Apologies that I just coughed right in your ear. dang, I had my finger on the trigger and everything. So that to me is an increasingly important part of this conversation, where we keep promising consumers more power, where are we using this power? Where is this compute power important? And especially as we get into Pixel 6, because we're gonna have some Pixel 6 rumors, and obviously, you know, a bunch of guys have been trying to like spoil everything about this Pixel 6 announcement. And again, if there's one trend that I would be wholeheartedly in support of for 2021, it's that leaks and rumor sites can go take a long walk off a short pier. They're just not fun anymore. So we have to address them because SEO, but it seems like the only thing techies have to contribute to a conversation is we have access to information that consumers don't have yet. And that's not really an interesting part of the gadget conversation. The interesting part is using it. So Aditya, I do worry about this, especially for your own mental health. As someone who bases my identity on Geekbench scores, consider my feelings offended. I do absolutely recognize that if your preferred device doesn't have the biggest scores on an app that no one uses for any type of actual work, then it could do detrimental harm to your reproductive organs. So Aditya, we all feel for you. We definitely do. Hopefully you'll be able to recover from this travesty of mine in showcasing how useless embedded benchmarks are. So that was just what got published to somegadgetguy.com. Obviously, we had a great conversation, best of our week, on Thursday last week. TK has been rocking the Soundcore Liberty 3 Pro. I shared a little bit more of my findings on the X70 Pro Plus cameras. I got to talk about my Video Maker event. I got to host an event with Sony where I was high out of my gourd on Sudafed. And then the new Surface Pen came in, which I also shot a quick short on, the Surface Slim Pen 2. Just looking at some of the backwards compatibility. I don't have a Duo 2 yet, but I do have the pen, the new pen. So I was able to kind of show on the Duo 1 that at least the new pen is still able to draw lines. And I feel like other companies that make stylus-enabled devices like tablets should probably learn something from not changing their pen tech. And then I did another short last week just talking about an optical effect that I think Apple is getting a lot of credit for. And it's funny, like most people in the comments of this short seem to understand what it is that I'm talking about. But one person was like, no, you're incorrect because Apple's cinematic mode is this. And I'm like, that's exactly what I said in the video. And like, he just wouldn't let it go. And so there's this thing that's happening. I've seen now three distinctly different videos where people are so impressed by the fake software blur in Apple Cinematic Mode, because when you move closer to the iPhone, the Cinematic Mode even changes the quality of the background blur behind them. And isn't that amazing? And that's not Cinematic Mode. That's just a basic feature of any camera with any lens. It's an optical effect. As you get closer to a camera, your background blurs more dramatically. As soon as your subject gets closer, there's a faster fall off of focus behind your subject. And so I showed it off on the Vivo, but as a way to demonstrate this. And again, there's just like one or two people that are like, no, see, what you have to understand is Apple's doing it with software. You're like, that's not what's happening. I love the little pop-ups too, because like I do that and then I get the warning on my streaming software like, oh, are you trying to say something? Because your mic is muted. Yeah, I did that on purpose. So, why is my broadcast? Come on, find me. There we go, NVIDIA. Ah, it's going to give me a haircut. That's fine. So, I made a little short about that. Again, it's 50 seconds. I'm explaining just the bare minimum of this. I'm not explaining all of the math and physics that goes into lens design. I'm just saying any camera you use will replicate this change in background blur. Has nothing to do with the fake software blur from Apple Cinematic Mode. I will throw a shout out. If you want just like a little bit more of a look at Cinematic Mode and some of the concerns over using software to blur your background, I would highly recommend checking out Engineer React's Barry Johnson on YouTube. Took a more in-depth look, shot like secondary cam using Apple Cinematic Mode, and it's very easy to see. You know, this is a man who kind of buzzes his head or shaves his head down, and Apple's Cinema Mode, you can still see like that hard halo of fake software blur on the edges of his skull. That's not something you would really want to use. I don't know anyone professionally trying to accomplish, you know, like a really good, you know, focused subject shot, you know, especially like a head and shoulder shot of an actor, who would want to see that kind of haloing effect from software blur. So for as many claims, you know, like we're going to get ProRes, we technically already have ProRes with Filmic, and all of these like pro capabilities of the iPhone, I think Apple oversold what they could do with software. Right now, I'm using a software blur effect with NVIDIA Broadcast. So tapping a pretty beefy GPU to process this in real time. And I still think it looks okay. It doesn't look great. And you can kind of see like on those borders, especially with some of the things like right there, if you're watching the video stream, off my right ear with that Soundwave transformer box in the background, you can see how it starts to fragment between my chair and the back of that box. Right there. Now the box is visible and it's not part of the blur effect because software can't figure out where my ear stops and the background begins. And again, I can like toggle this real quick just so you can see this is like the lens. I don't have a lot of room in this office. I don't have a lot of depth. So I can't separate myself as well because I'm kind of halfway in my office. And so just at the barest minimum, this is the lowest setting blur for NVIDIA Broadcast. Just to soften things out, I would never use this for like shooting a short film. I feel like this is really good for hosting a live stream, but this would not work at all if I wanted to try and do like a short movie or something like that. So that's like the main bulk of everything that went out. Everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the housekeeping, all of our news stories, you can find all of the links for that for this week's show on the show notes, somegadgetguide.com. But yeah, there's so much stuff on my desk to catch up on. I apologize. Someone mentioned it. Simon says, no, fragmented ear syndrome is a real thing. Yeah, it's pretty rough. But again, like I want people to be excited, and I get excited about something like this. I'm using NVIDIA Broadcast. This is really good software for what we're trying to do right here. It softens my background a little bit. It brings me forward in the shot. It blurs this out in a way where I don't have to have like a cinema grade, ridiculous cine lens, you know, fetishistically shallow depth of field to accomplish this shot right here. So I mean, like that's really good. But use where appropriate. Not like I'm not going to try and convince you that I'm doing this off of like a fancy camera and a really nice lens because it doesn't hold up to that. Excuse me. From ER1980, I haven't seen this if he did. Didn't Chris Perillo do a comparison between the iPhone 13 Pro Max and the Pixel 4 XL still images recently? Apparently the Pixel 4 XL showed its prowess in that comparison. I have not been super impressed with the iPhone photo samples that I've been seeing. Especially from the 13 Pro. I feel a lot of those images are getting washed out. I think even just that minor increase in sensor size, I don't believe Apple has trained their algorithms for the increased light very well. This is something that you can see if you go to my OnePlus 9 camera deep dive. the image sensor on the OnePlus 9, I believe, is ever so slightly larger than the camera sensor in the iPhone 13 Pro. And we're talking main sensors here. Obviously, the ultra-wide, no one's touching OnePlus this year. The OnePlus 9 ultra-wide sensor is just stunningly good. But if you go through, and I do a section on RAW files, and you look at the output that the phone actually captures free of image processing, and if you're shooting in bright daylight conditions, every shot is just ridiculously blown out. Now, what I feel is happening here is they're trying to balance HDR, compositing, stacking images. The sensor can bin pixels for either low light or HDR capabilities. And when you go raw, it's really just about maximizing light. Well, the iPhone camera sensor doesn't have a quad pixel array. It's a traditional RGB sensor, and it got a little bit bigger. And I think what they're doing is, I think what's happening is we're seeing they're capturing so much light now with this larger sensor, but they're still kind of finishing off the JPEG based on older models. That's what it looks like to me. I'm completely speculating here. But one of the advantages, and especially when you talk about a Pixel 4 XL, you do get a longer depth of field, but that can be better for the human face. If you miss critical focus on a larger camera sensor from a phone with a shallower depth of field and a faster aperture, it doesn't look as good. It looks blurrier. Your snapshotty photos, especially the average consumer point-and-shoot stuff, is actually more difficult than what you've got on a Pixel 4. So again, I'm shooting on the Vivo, and the Vivo is yet another step bigger than the OnePlus 9. Again, it's in Galaxy Ultra territory, and these sensors are shocking. But at the same time, they can be more difficult to use. Brighter conditions, shallower depth of field, you can ruin a shot because the camera hardware is too good. So I wouldn't be surprised. And also, I mean, from Chris Perrello's perspective, I don't think he's been feeling iPhones for a while. So I think it's important to kind of like balance those things out. I know people are like, oh, Pixels, well, yeah, they're going to have good photo quality, but video, that's where we're really concerned. And first of all, I feel like Pixel video has been getting substantially better since the Pixel 4. But I feel like we keep kind of dancing around, but missing the point. You know, a Pixel is not making a pro argument. The first Pixel that will be making a pro argument is the Pixel 6, literally in the name. The Pixel 4 is not a Pixel 4 Pro, it's a Pixel 4 XL. And Google, I think rightfully, is advertising and focusing on premium tier experiences for a certain set of consumers, but they're not trying to say, you know what you can do with your Pixel 4 or your Pixel 5a is go and shoot feature films. Yeah, because it's a pro phone. Apple is making that claim. And I don't think Apple is living up to that claim. I think Google, up to now, has been under-promising, which means like the actual experience of using a Pixel out in the field over-delivers. And I don't think the companies are really being fairly judged by what their marketing and what their actual capabilities resemble. So there was another one here. Hold on. Take a drink of water. And Aditya is telling me to stretch. I'm going to stretch. Ah. Ugh. Ah. From Steve, DP Review took a gander at the iPhone 13 Pro's fake video blur, and it looks somewhat better when dialing down the aperture, but it's definitely not ready yet to actually look convincing. Absolutely agree. I love the way that DP Review talks about cameras. And I love that, like, excuse me, when they go hands-on with a phone camera, they seem more inclined to really test out some of these, like, side features. Like, if someone picks up a phone like a Vivo, and they like, well, to be fair to all the other phones, we're only going to shoot full auto, then you're missing 90% of that camera. Like, you're missing so much of that camera. So I would wholly believe that Apple's cinematic mode is dramatic when you're already shooting in conditions that are brilliantly controlled for that specific style of processing. So like Apple can show us these amazing marketing materials, right? The cinematic mode looks so cool when we see it in a commercial. But ultimately what I think we're seeing is highly controlled environments. So if you're out there buying an iPhone 13 Pro for cinematic mode, you should also probably invest in a multi-million dollar production facility to get the most out of it so that you can kind of use it for your next film project. So, Fat Produce is in the chat. Everyone say, hey, Andrew. And I'm glad to hear Greg's arm is getting better. Greg, I think, had a minor mishap and is healing up from that. Let me get that out of the way there. Catching up on the chat. There's a lot of conversation happening about bone conduction audio. That's exciting. I love it. And then this right here. So this is why I've been reluctant to move up to a larger sensor on a phone. It has its advantages, but these nuances and gremlins still plaguing larger sensors on phones. It's why I'm perfectly happy with the recycled cameras on the Z Fold 3. So to a point, your Z Fold 3 is moving up to a larger sensor. What's happening is I think we're seeing three tiers of camera sensor. I mean, and I'm talking mostly for main sensors. The most established, I mean, like, I think the best balance of more consumer-style point-and-shoot, trained algorithms, and accessibility without taking up a ton of space on the inside of the phone is the Pixel camera sensor size. The iPhone 12 Pro had it. The iPhone 11s and 10Rs, that's the camera sensor size of choice for those. Pixel 4a, Pixel 4... Pixel 5, 5a, it's that 1 over 2.55 inch sensor. That's a stonking good piece of camera. It really is just beautifully functional, well understood, and companies are getting a lot out of it without having to invest a lot into it. Then we start moving up to the 1 over 1.7 inch size sensors. That's what we find in a Sony Xperia. That's what we find in the iPhone 12 Pro, 12 Pro Max, in the iPhone 13s. And in the Galaxy S21s. So the S21, S21 Plus, Z Fold, Z Flip. It's already a larger sensor, but it's not a pixel binning sensor. It's a traditional RGB stripe. So we go from just smaller than a half inch to just larger than a half inch. And then from there, from OnePlus 9 on, we start getting those mega camera sensors. 1 over 1.4, 1 over 1.3, often, you know, 48 megapixel to 108 megapixel, all of those different combinations of sub-pixel arrangements. And that's where we start seeing some of those pros and cons really manifest. It might be slower autofocus. It might be sort of a streakier depth of field because it's so shallow. You have a hard time pinpointing the exact critical focus on your subject. Processing times can get longer because it's just so much data. That's, you know, we're talking tiers. And I don't think techies have done a very good job of kind of highlighting what the pros and cons of those tiers are. It's really difficult to sort of conceptualize because you just hear like, oh, it's going to be a bigger camera sensor. And you're like, okay, cool. We're talking about tiny little pieces of light gathering equipment. So those changes need to be demonstrated. you can't just play it off like, oh, well, it's going to be better for night mode. Well, show us. You know, night modes can't really get brighter than they have already. So what is it that improves when we talk about low light performance, night mode, HDR processing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So it's silly, but like being able to at least show some work. So I finished shooting all of the A-roll for my Vivo X70 Pro Plus. I was gonna try and combine the Pro and the Pro Plus. It's too much. It's genuinely way too much for me to put into a single video. The number of cameras on the back of this thing right here I couldn't do a combo video. The differences are slight and they're nuanced, but it's just way too much data to put in. So just this phone with these four cameras and the myriad number of camera modes, post-processing options, video, HDR, Zeiss color, manual modes, manual video, log. You can shoot in log. Again, it's a feature I've missed since the V30 if you want a color grade. I talked for almost 70 minutes describing the camera performance on the Pro Plus. I would say 3/4 of that is really going to make it into the finished camera deep dive. So that's going to be, I think, the longest camera review I've ever produced. And it's like, I don't know how to make it much shorter. So it's not going to be all 68 minutes, Dave Burns, but it is going to be a lot. And so I've got the main timeline roughly trimmed, but I've got to do a little bit more just kind of cleaning and scrubbing. And then I've got to put in all of the samples. So I'm hoping, fingers crossed, I'm hoping to have the Patreon version of that out on Wednesday. And then the camera conclusion, the shortened YouTube version of that out on Friday. I mean, again, this is like the most ambitious phone camera I think I've ever reviewed. So this is one of the biggest camera videos I've ever put together. All right. So hold on. Brother Bamboo. Oh, about the Vivo. How's the curved screen on the Pro Plus? The Pixel 6 Pro is rumored to be the same panel. I am not the biggest fan of curved displays. I really wish Android were smart enough to say the edges of your screen wrap, so we're going to do things like pull UI elements into the center of the screen. I hate that feeling as you're typing, where you get to like just those edge characters and like you've got to cramp in your thumbs or splay out your hands to kind of reach the edges of the screen. When it comes to using a phone as some kind of production piece, it's not so much just the curved screen, but it's the case that Vivo has included is terrifying to use. With having the sides exposed, I don't know if I can actually show this off very well. Right there, they pre-apply a plastic screen guard. It's not the best feeling screen protector, but it's just a nice consideration that there's something on the phone when you pull it out of the box. And you can already see, like for me, like digging this phone into the dirt, taking my macro photos, rolling around, I've already like torn into the screen protector. It's already splitting and pulling from the phone. I haven't had it that long, but I shoot heavy when I shoot my camera reviews. And then I've just been using it for almost everything. I mean, like the indoor lighting performance on this thing is insane. I've got an almost 6-year-old daughter who never sits still. And even on like a OnePlus 9, and we know the OnePlus 9 does that after capture, you hit the shutter and then it kind of picks the sharpest image from a burst. It doesn't pick the exact moment that you hit the shutter. I'll still get like streaked images of her in motion. And I've been capturing, you know, like in lower light, just like a lamp or from the light of the TV, my daughter's playing around or something and I tap it and it like just snick. And like, that's the image. None of the shutter lag of a Samsung, none of the post-processing of a OnePlus, or after image selection of a OnePlus. It's crazy. I mean, like I have been digging the stills that come off of the Pro Plus. It's very encouraging. Sorry, to get back to the original question from there though, it is terrifying to like if you get an X70 Pro Plus and you want to use it to really go and shoot stuff, you've got to put it in some other case. This little kind of wraparound corner edge case is not the thing. It is not gonna allow your phone to survive. Oh, no. Hold on, we got to put this one up. From Slick Rick Moranis. Oh, I'm sorry to hear this. What up, Juan? I hope you're feeling better. Bonked my head this morning, clearing yellow jacket wasps out of a crawl space. Still a bit fuzzy, so I'll have to replay the stream when my brain isn't so confused. If you hit your head hard and you're finding you're having some issues later on in the day, I would highly recommend speaking with some kind of medical professional. I would not sleep on a head injury, both literally and figuratively. So I hope you're feeling better soon. Definitely take care of yourself. That's kind of mandatory. So hold on one second. I'm gonna clear some biology for just a second. I'll be right back.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Oh, man, that was horrifically disgusting. Now, I mean, just to understand the noise that my face just made, the screen grab, the terrible thumbnail, it kind of sounded like my face looks in that YouTube short. So, yeah, that wasn't just a cough. It started out as a cough and then turned into an entire, like, passage clearance. So there are a couple news stories that I want to tag pretty quick because housekeeping has been going on for 40 minutes now. And honestly, I'd rather just make this, if we want to make this one more just like casual conversation, talking about some of the review gear that I've got. If you have any other questions about, like, you know, Vivos, I'll do the rundown here real quick. So Vivo also sent their True Wireless, so I'm going to be taking a listen to those. But just yesterday, I fired up the Edifiers. So I'm now breaking in the Neo Buds Pro. This is the one that has the really cool, like, Cylon LED indicator on the front. Early impressions, again, for something that's hitting around that $100 price point, these have been phenomenal. At the same time, I got to show these off because I'm kind of a big deal, guys. I don't know if you know this, but audio companies think I'm pretty nifty. So these are the new Behr Dynamics. These are the DT700 Pro X. And so these just showed up over the weekend too. And I've just been breaking these in to kind of complement. I only have these for a short loaner. I even have to send them back. I've got my DT770s. These are the DT700. So I'm going to be doing a little compare and contrast on these guys right here. And I think I'm going to produce the review on their new studio mic, which is the M70 Pro X. So this is going to get broken in. NVIDIA Broadcast does not like it when I hold up boxes. This is awesome. I hope you guys aren't getting too seasick. And then I got to reach for it. It's over here. I've been complaining for a while about things like larger camera sensors on phones and how to get the most out of them. And I shoot almost everything handheld. I'll admit, I'm a sound guy by trade. I've been writing about photography and cameras for years. And I've been shooting, you know, I've been shooting since high school. I feel it's time for me to start putting a little bit more of the effort into some of the footage that I capture that I describe people should be able to do. So I'm going to take a few baby steps in picking up accessories that I think really facilitate that. And one of the key usability concerns of larger smartphone sensors is light, right? If you try to shoot cinematic video, your phone is going to be cranking a ridiculous shutter speed and it's going to look really choppy. It's not going to look very good. So I've started picking up some pieces to better control how it is that I'm utilizing smartphone cameras. On the way, I've just ordered an ND filter, like a little clip-on ND filter. But the housing that I'm going to be trying to shoot some of this content, I did just get a small rig. So this is a whole cage and shell. You know, I might have to turn off auto frame for just a second here. Let's do that. Okay. So this is a whole cage and shell that you can put your phone in, adjustable. So far, it's fit pretty well on a OnePlus 9. It doesn't fit on a Vivo very well because the Vivo camera bulge kind of pushes the back of the phone out of the cage. But I'm going to be really anxious to see how it might work with a Pixel 6, because that's another really big camera sensor bulge. But hand grip, you know, cold shoe mounts, multiple threads, you can connect it to tripods. But the thing that's getting me really lit up is a 37 millimeter filter thread here where you can screw in lenses and filters. So it's got the bayonet. And if I want to start picking up some moment lenses, I could. But the thing I really want isn't necessarily different optics. I want an ND filter so that I can stop this lens down. And I can't do that from the phone. Like, I can't make the image darker from the sensor. So this is going to be getting some heavy highlights soon as I start kind of tearing into some of this commentary for Kit. So I got a bunch of stuff here. And if we want to talk about some of that other stuff, we can talk about some of that other stuff. sorry, I just had to do the rundown, because I'm super scattered and I've got a lot on my brain. Simon says, Hypno Gadget, level up to the max. Dojin, I mean, it really is. I've played with a couple different mounts. Again, if you're saying that's proper neat about the small rig, I've seen a bunch of these, like, it's kind of a phone cradle and it's got these rails and you can use accessories with it. And I've played with some and you get them and, like, it's two metal rails and then a bunch of plastic. I'm not making this into a commercial for the small rig, but the phone mount inside is also aluminum, and that's all metal. The entire outside casing, metal. The entire mounting system, metal. The hand grip that is purchased separately, I opted for the all-aluminum hand grip to connect. And then the rails, it's the same thing. It's single thumb screw. And it's machined almost with, like, weapons grade machining, so I'm very impressed. I'm very happy that I spent, you know, like, the 20 extra dollars over one of the other cages that I was looking at to just go small rig, because it's impressively built considering how people often kind of disregard phone photography. You know, I'll leave a link. I'm sorry, a couple people have asked. I'll leave a link to the small rig. But if you go to small rig, if you just search for small rig, they've got their own website too. Let me get this out of the way there. Mark Sequence, what's up? What's with this guy? What's all this then? The one and only. Hey, nice of you to drop by, man. I appreciate you jumping in. And then get that out of the way. Some Dojin, the rig itself was $99. I opted for the more expensive hand grip that was $38. And then the ND filter I'm getting is one of the newers. That's going to be $40. But the thing I like about it is I've used iPhone cases that have different mounts. I don't know if I've, yeah. So, like, this is my Rhino Shield iPhone case, and it's for the iPhone SE. And like, the cases aren't prohibitively expensive, but they've got, like, these little drop-in panels so you can use a bayonet and attach a camera lens to it. I really dig that. But this case and this little drop-in piece won't work with anything else, right? It's unique to this one phone. So we're looking at, I don't know, I want to say, like, when this was brand new, it was like 25, I want to say, for the system. And then you would buy the lens that would connect to this, proprietary to this one phone. So while this cage is very expensive, it's built like something you would expect to put on a more professional camera. And then it's not married to one phone. It should be more versatile. The only concern I have is camera sensors and camera bulges getting increasingly bigger. I might need to figure out some way of adapting the side rail where the top of the phone goes so that it can angle into this that's going to be a longer term conversation. But what I'm hoping is that this for $100 is going to do a better job of swapping when I have different devices to review and different phones to play with, that we can move that stuff kind of around a bit more. So I can get this out of the... Oh, hey, Tech Loving Mama's in. What's up? Everyone say, hey, Tech Loving Mama. I always a ray of sunshine in my stream when I see that username pop up. Get this out of the way here. All right. So like I said, I did have a couple stories, and we're almost an hour into the show. you know what? Let's do a quick breakdown on stories. I'm going to have all these links on somegadgetguide.com. I'm just going to ask that folks out there that you keep up with some of these headlines, because I think I think they're going to be stories that kind of that evolve over time, but they're going to be stories that have an impact on each of their industries. The first one is very concerning to me. I used to have a great relationship with some of the PR that worked for AT&T, and I always had kind of a conflict with AT&T as a corporation. They would get very vocal, trying to work against things like net neutrality. We were always kind of button heads about some of the company's plans for that. And then recently, we covered it here on the podcast a while back. You know, they got that massive tax credit. They got that massive tax break from the previous presidential administration under the guise of, if you let us pay less in taxes, this will encourage us to hire more people. It'll be this great job benefit. And then AT&T immediately took all of the savings of those tax breaks and fired like tens of thousands of their employees. And then that further bumped their stock price up, and all the shareholders, you know, were laughing all the way to the bank. So we paid them to lay people off during a really challenging time. So when a story like this pops up, it's even more concerning. This is a Reuters special report, and I am linking directly to the Reuters article on the show notes. How AT&T helped build far-right One America News Network. So with all of the lobbying that AT&T has done for owning media and for paying less in taxes and for kind of leaning into some of the areas where they occupy, you know, home broadband and cell carrier, almost not monopolistically, but you know, with very little competition, all of these business practices combined. And then we find out One America News Network is funded to the tune of almost 90% by AT&T as a direct propaganda machine. And this to me is further upsetting from the previous relationships that I used to have with AT&T PR. I mean, you can go back to like the early archives on my channel, and I was covering a lot of AT&T gear for getting my hands on phones, services. I mean, I covered their home security system and network, you know, stuff like that. And I really enjoyed working with their PR team. These kinds of moves, I find very troubling. Like when we talk about a corporation's ability to influence the conversation, we're getting real hip to Facebook and how Facebook can manipulate media. This to me is another example of that, that is even a hair more concerning for how it's presented, packaged, described. I feel like this is a story that needed more attention. So please, Reuters has a deep dive on the relationship between these two companies, sort of the inception, the funding, how they came together, how they're being presented and packaged to consumers. And it's troubling. It's very troubling stuff. From Trey, hold on, let me just read through this comment here. I had AT&T for years only because they were the lesser of two evils between Verizon and them, but they were more supportive of Unlocked and had a better selection of phones. But then they changed their support of Unlocked phones and only carried Samsung and Apple phones, and I was out of there, especially because T-Mobile had become reliable enough in my area. This is gross to hear. We we kind of do need to take some of this stuff personally. Oh, sorry, I meant to click on that while I was reading it, not click on it after I was done. I clicked on it to close the comment, and I hadn't ever opened the comment. Who we give our money to support, I mean, who we give our money to for goods and services in turn supports their business practices. And I feel like this next generation of consumerism, we need to have some very frank conversations about how we support different initiatives, how we empower consumers with better information, and how we stem misinformation and disinformation campaigns. Moving right along. This isn't groundbreaking. This isn't like some huge headline. We kind of knew this was coming, but it's official now. The Apple versus Epic lawsuit finally wrapped. Both Apple and Epic are likely going to be fighting back against some of the judgment of the first case, but it seems Apple got their appeal properly registered first. So I'm going to be linking to the CNBC story. Apple files appeal in Epic's games case, potentially delaying the App Store changes for years. So if you're a developer, one of the major conclusions of the Apple case was Apple being forced to allow developers to include alternative payments in their apps. At present, and in like digging through this story and then reading up like on Reddit and some of the other forums where people are talking about some of these changes, Apple is being really cagey about how this policy will be instituted in the App Store, and this appeal will probably push pause on some of those changes in the near term. So if I were a developer, I would be very, if I were a developer and I were looking at putting in other ways that you can, you know, charge money to your customer on your app or service, I would be very conservative. I would be very cautious about how to institute some of those, because it looks like Apple is going to fight tooth and claw about having to change any of their App Store policy. I think it's really funny because according to Apple executives, like, they don't even know if the App Store brings in any money. I mean, under oath, Schiller was testifying on behalf of Apple that, like, he just doesn't even look into it. You know, he doesn't even check if the App Store makes any money for Apple. It's just not how he sees the business, you know? It's all about the feels, right? When you're a part of a $1 trillion corporation, like, you don't care if, you know, you're selling out search data to Google for $10 billion a year while advertising about privacy. You don't care if you've created this entire monopolistic walled garden of app developers that are giving you 30% of all the money that they make. You just don't even look at the numbers, man. It's not about the numbers. I'm insulted that you would even bring up numbers, because it's about the feels. It just works. That's what we're about. So it's just pants on head silly that they would be, you know, appealing this and fighting so hard if it's not about protecting a ridiculous amount of revenue. Yeah, they're gonna fight this one hard. It's because it's just free money for them. From Russ, it'll be interesting to see if they switch their phones to USB-C. So this is my prediction. I hope I am wrong. I believe that based on the rules that the EU is setting forth, Apple will have enough time to put out an iPhone, the next iPhone, iPhone 14. And then for iPhone 15, we're going to see the completely sealed up iPhone. No ports. That's my prediction. They're going to get around the window that the EU has given them by just releasing something with no ports, so they don't have to use USB-C, and then they can license even more expensive accessories to charge and transfer data on your iPhone. From Paul, hey, I pay Apple good money to curtail my consumer rights. Paul just recently got himself a 1 terabyte iPhone, so, you know, it's how we do. All right. From Russ. That's my prediction to a portless iPhone. From Kappa Cash, Apple not getting their cut is bad for users' privacy. Yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah, especially like when there was a major fallout in the App Store, 120 million potential victims of like malware on the App Store, and Apple like, oh, we didn't tell anyone. Yeah, like 120 million of our customers might have been affected, but you know what? That would look bad for all of our privacy and security commercials. So we just didn't say anything. I mean, we'll probably fix it. We're good for that, but you know, alerting people, that's not our responsibility. We just own and operate this completely locked up app store. It's how we do, because that would be a bad look for us, and then we'd make less money. We're Apple. So, another bad look, and especially this one hurts me. I am a huge fan of Firefox, but I am tragically disappointed in this next move from Mozilla. This one was shared, a couple links were shared. I believe Dave Burns and I forget, someone else on the Discord were talking about this one here too. You can see I'm screen sharing from my Firefox browser right now. Firefox now sends your address bar keystrokes to Mozilla. This is coming by way of How to Geek. Chris Hoffman has been writing up some great articles on Firefox 93. This is the newest update to Firefox, where contextual data is now being sent to a Mozilla server, and Firefox will helpfully suggest advertisements in your search, which is a big no-no for me. So what I love is he's breaking down exactly what Mozilla support is explaining about this, but then at the bottom, he's just like, oh, and if you go into your settings and you disable contextual suggestions, that's going to turn off this pipe of information back to Mozilla. So if you're using Firefox, like I am, super invested in Firefox. I use Firefox as my phone browser, as my main desktop browser. I really like Firefox. I would recommend being of two minds. I donated once, like 5 years ago. I'm going to donate again, but I'm also going to send a message to Mozilla support just saying, this type of move being activated by default, I think is a big, big no-no. I feel there are a number of people out there who might, out of the goodwill, say, hey, you know, contextual ads in my search bar will contribute to funding Firefox. I can opt into that. Or I trust Mozilla to handle this data responsibly. Turning it on by default is bad. That is unequivocally not okay. Enough for me to even consider like what other browser solutions might I be willing to transfer to. But at the same time, Mozilla has been taking a beating. They've been putting out the best work I think this company has accomplished in years. And at the same time, we're seeing their market share fall. It's tough because I want there to... It sounds so silly because we're talking about a web browser. You know, like the web browser wars were fought in the early days of dial-up. Like, I'm old enough to remember all of that garbage. But I still want there to be competition, and I'm living that competition because I genuinely enjoy their product and I prefer it. But this is the type of move that we need to make noise about. This is not the way to accomplish it. I feel like putting up bigger donations, the drives that we see for the Internet Archive or Wikipedia, you know, doing a membership drive for Firefox and building services like, you know, they've recently I forget who they partnered with, but they offer a VPN service, and that's a paid service. You know, like that, those are the types of things that we need to encourage more of those business practices, as opposed to yet another attempt at sneakily turning on user identification and behavior tracking to sell people stuff through advertisements on their platform. I'm not okay with that. That's the main reason why I opted for Firefox over Chrome. Well, performance was number one, but number two, I felt like Mozilla was locking all that stuff down better. If they're going to open it up, what's the advantage of using Firefox over using something like Chrome? So I feel like it's on me, because I've talked about Firefox a lot, it's on me to also share this because it hurts my soul. So Paul Puri is saying, you're saying Firefox should switch to a subscription model. What I would like to see them do first is a donation model. So you can go to Mozilla and you can donate, but you know, what I would love to see is like the way that Wikipedia does a hard membership drive, the way that Internet Archive works with outlets like PayPal. So you can do like a purchase through PayPal, and then you can say, hey, and also do you want to chip in a dollar to the Internet Archive? What I would like to see is the first step being more visibility, more advertising, more strategic partnerships to bring awareness to Mozilla's collection of services and products, so that we can knowingly just give them money directly. And then from there, we can talk about other things too, like Firefox is just the core browsing package. And then from there, if I want to add a VPN, that can be an additional fee per month that helps contribute to yet another partnership for Mozilla with their VPN provider, and it gives me a benefit as well. I feel like opening up a collection of services that do a better job of marketing and bringing in revenue is better for the image of Mozilla than flipping a switch and now piping search bar activity from your web browser directly to Mozilla servers. And I don't feel like Mozilla has seriously attempted the other alternatives for monetization. Not in the way that I've kind of just described here. I feel like obviously they market and they advertise and they reach out and they do community stuff, but I feel like they've missed some of the potential of direct consumer interactions by talking mostly about the services and products they provide. Not just the, we need money, you know, kind of putting your hand out. We have a soft spot in our hearts for Wikipedia. We have a soft spot in our hearts for Internet Archive. They do all of this fundraising. They do all of this outreach. Mozilla should be in that camp. Like, we should be putting Mozilla in the same bucket of goodwill that we put Internet Archive, archive.org, Wikipedia. That to me seems like a no-brainer. And I feel like that's a problem of messaging. That's a problem of optics. Paul Puri, they say freedom isn't free, but privacy is a lot more expensive. Oh, and Trey, I mean, again, for talking about good alternatives, Trey says he's been nudging people off of Chrome and onto Edge since it doesn't feed Google's monopoly. I don't know. I just feel like now I'm that little step more encouraged to check out Brave or check out what was the other browser that I was just looking at. Like, I've been using Edge a lot as like a PDF viewer, but there's more that I feel like I should be digging into. Now, speaking of ads, because you know, ads with Mozilla, that's bad. I feel like that's a bad look. Mozilla built on that privacy conversation and security conversation, open source, uses its own browsing engine as opposed to just another Chromium, flavor. This is one that I feel is potentially very scary, but that we don't have a lot of good data on just yet to explain like the true consumer implications. So what I'll be linking to on the show notes is from the Android Dev subreddit, r/AndroidDev. And they're digging into the potential concerns that certain advertisements on certain Android phones might be able to install apps without the user consent because of a core piece of software that carriers and phone manufacturers can use to image a phone quickly. So Digital Turbine DSP is a platform service. I am grossly oversimplifying, and I'm probably getting some of the nuance of this wrong. But Dave Burns actually sent this my way too. So I might point everyone into the comments right now. Go bug Dave. But again, to oversimplify, when you get a phone from a carrier, it installs this whole like package of, you know, value-added software from the carrier. Or like, let's say you have an unlocked phone, but there's a bunch of bloatware, you know, like value-added software. The manufacturer gets paid by companies to pre-install their apps and services on your phone. This automation might be able to be utilized by advertisers building specific kinds of ads to tap into the ability to kind of pre-image a phone. And that seems to be what we're looking at here. You go to a website, you maybe interact with an ad, and then suddenly there's like a new app on your phone, and this process can happen free of the user's interaction to verify the installation because it's using what the phone would use at setup to pre-install all of this software for you. And in sometimes, like on Samsung phones, let's say you get an unlocked model and then you use it on AT&T, this imaging can happen where, oh, we see that you're on AT&T, we're gonna install all of the AT&T apps and services for you as a convenience. But of course, I bought an unlocked phone because I wanted an unlocked phone, not an AT&T phone. So it's not a benefit. You're not doing me a kindness. You're making a mess of my phone. So, and from Dave Burns, this is exactly why I'm cagey about this one, but it's absolutely something we need to take a look at because this would be an amazing way to deliver malware, right? And we don't know what Android devices are going to be more susceptible. Like, are carrier branded phones going to be more susceptible? Are unlocked phones that do a lot of work with pre-installation, is that going to be more susceptible to this? And so Dave writes, story still developing, but Digital Turbine is showcasing this as a feature of their advertising platform, and then third parties could use this to install applications, which the app in the thread clones your launcher, but replaces Google Now with their own version. So pretty gross. Need to keep an eye on it. And I love that in Android land, we have this kind of more aggressive securities focused, you know, like you can't have security through obscurity. Like the moment we started to see some kind of impropriety happening with advertisements and app installations, immediately we're seeing these kinds of conversations free of like, you know, like, oh, I'm going to post on this security forum and then someone's going to take my comment down because it makes them look bad. You know, that kind of stuff is kind of a big deal. So, very serious story to keep an eye on. I'm going to take another drink of water. But yeah, very concerning. So, bummed about Mozilla, a little anxious about Android phones just dumping garbage on your phone there. That's probably real bad. Again, I feel, let's say we had a better platform of really reducing the type of garbage ads that we might encounter while we use other apps and services, while we use our web browser, like the great plugins I've grown accustomed to using on my Firefox browser, which now sends all of my search data to Mozilla, but has great plugins to like compartmentalize Facebook and Facebook services, and then locks so many of the bad ads that I encounter. I'm telling you, it was such a mess. It's just such a tangled, gnarly mess. I just love it. It's so gross. Let me get this out of the way here. Oh, sorry. Ah, dang it. I'm trying not to cough in the mic. I apologize. A little bit of YouTube news. I feel like there will be much rejoicing. I don't know. There's just something about the whole, like, year rewind, patting ourselves on the back for being a platform. It doesn't really celebrate the people on your platform. It kind of, it's a way to celebrate yourself. So I don't think anyone's going to be too upset to see that YouTube Rewind is properly gone. So YouTube to stop making year-end Rewind videos. This is coming by way of Tube Filter, written up by Jeff Weiss. Definitely give this kind of a read through, because it's just, I don't know that Rewind has ever been great optics. I feel like it's always been kind of gross. And especially in light of like the massive leak that happened at Twitch, where, you know, the source code of the website and all of the payment details of all of the people that produce on Twitch was kind of leaked out there. I don't know that there's such a feeling of community because of the platform anymore. Like, I'm not excited to be a YouTuber. I'm excited to have these kinds of conversations with people that I care about and people that share interests, and I want to build something, but I'm building it, and like, I'm doing this on Twitch right now. You know, again, I'm kind of throwing shade at YouTube, but like, let's be fair, I picked one massive trillion-dollar corporation over another. But I'm utilizing those platforms and I'm utilizing those services not to be a part of the platform, not to be a part of the service. It's just I need the free hosting, right? So that's, I feel like it's the right move by YouTube. It's fine. We're not going to miss it. All we used to do was wait for you to come out with it, and then we would make fun of it. So that's okay. It's okay to let this go now. I don't miss the Rewind. I feel like the last time YouTube did something that I felt did actually celebrate the people on their platform in a clever or a novel way, I want to say it was 2012? Might have been 2010? I remember I was still doing a lot of work in casting in Burbank. I remember watching it and streaming it while I was in one of the studios recording in Burbank. So it was a while ago. It might have been like 8 or 9 years ago. They did an April Fool's joke where it was the YouTube Awards. And the whole shtick of the April Fool's joke was every video that had ever been submitted to YouTube was an official nominee. And so before they could announce the winners, they had to read off the titles and the first line of the description of every video on YouTube. And they had two presenters, and I believe those two presenters streamed for like 10 hours reading titles of YouTube videos. And like, we're talking like obscure, like this video has 3 views, and it was like a real YouTube video. And they just kept going and going. They would take breaks to do like in memoriam, like on a real awards show. And they did like, you know, like a montage of some of our favorite, you know, hiking videos, and they smashed them all together. That's the last time I feel like YouTube got the vibe right. It was an April Fool's joke, but it was like a 10-hour stream love letter to all of the funky things that you could find on YouTube back in the day. And since then, everything that I've seen coming from YouTube, I've got my silver play button out of focus in the background there, which to me is as much a slap in the face from the platform as it is a celebration of the people that stream with me and work with me and join my conversations. That I feel like YouTube has lost it. You know, like whatever charm or magic the platform used to have is gone. So let's stop congratulating ourselves for being the platform. And Rewind brings nothing to that chat.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Thanks, Juan Carlos, for allowing me to be part of your show. And I want to introduce myself to you guys. My name is TK Bay, and I've been doing YouTube for quite some time, almost 10 years now. And you can find me online by just looking for TK Bay, either on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. But the general consensus is I'm a tech reviewer. I provide an interesting way of approaching tech by the same way you would actually go ask your friend for help. That's generally the consensus of how my channel runs. I review anything from Android, iOS, PC computers, scooters, basically, you know, drones, anything that you think of as consumer tech. I generally try to get my hands on it and share with you guys my opinions. And of course, any troubleshooting or even tips and tricks that can help you enjoy your tech even better. Again, thank you very much to Juan Carlos. But if you'd like to check me out, just look for at TKDSL8655 on Instagram and Twitter, or TK Bay in YouTube.
Sorry, let me get this out of the way here. I was just kind of trying to catch up. Oh, from Aditya. Is he officially announcing only wands? I'm not going to do an only wands. I know you seem really invested in me doing this. Oh, you know. And Mark, and like, I know Mark's trying to like talk, you know, trying to throw some shade here. Oh, I thought only Apple was evil. Other companies are evil data miner sellers too. If criticisms of Apple, and the only thing that you can kind of bring up is the whataboutism of others, I feel like you're kind of missing the point. Apple makes the biggest claims about their privacy and security, and those claims deserve scrutiny. So what is the scrutiny? We don't sell your data. Oh, but for $10 billion a year, we'll give your data to Google. You can't change search, but we don't profit off of selling your data, but we're happy to sell your data. Privacy and security. Oh, when there's a massive app crisis and we let malware in through the app store and there's no alternative for you to install software except for the app store, a company doing responsible security work would notify their consumers. And time again, Apple shuts those conversations down. They don't alert their users. And then we have to find out about that kind of stuff in lawsuits, in like courtroom testimony. Let's talk about the wonderful relationship they have with developers. Tim Cook testified under oath in front of a judicial committee. Oh, we treat everybody the same. Yeah, but Mr. Cook, don't some app developers get like preferential treatment? Oh, well, yes. There are ways that you can do different things on the App Store, but we treat everybody the same. But they're different, but we treat them the same. And then again, we have to find out in courtroom testimony that like their developer policies are draconian. And then here they are talking about the environment while being the biggest proponent against right to repair legislation. It's fine. My criticisms of a $1 trillion corporation are criticisms of a $1 trillion corporation. But they traffic more of your data directly to their servers. They're the only ones talking about implementing on-device scanning. They're working against the environment for their own profitability. They maintain ridiculous legacy hardware just so they can extract more licensing cash out of their accessories manufacturers and their customers. I don't know what, you know, what we have to do to support Apple. Like when you give your money to Apple, that's all the stuff you support. So I'm totally fine if an individual says like, well, you know, an iPhone is the best fit for my needs. That's fine. But understand your money is going to all of that. And so as much as we want to rag on Google sells your data. Yeah. And that's exactly what you're going to find when you use an iPhone. Apple trafficking your data, potentially scanning your device for content, narking on you if it finds a false positive. And then you still get all of your data sold off to Google, all of your search behavior, all of your interactions. So it's like you get to double dip on privacy issues on Apple. I didn't even bring up AirTags. AirTags, again, you get to opt in for Apple's network of location tracking. But, you know, if like a Tile ever did that, oh, we'd be crying doom and gloom. How could Tile opt me in automatically to track my location? And that's exactly what's happening, even if you don't own AirTags. So again, we can play the whataboutism game, but Apple loses the whataboutism game. Apple doesn't win this. Apple's marketing is way better. That's where they win. I just felt like that needed to be said. Oh, hey, Barry's in the chat. Everyone say, hey, Barry. Barry, I don't know if you caught this. I gave you the big plug. I wanted people to go and catch your cinematic, your video on Apple, the iPhone 13 cinematic mode. All right, moving right along. You know, I've got two news stories left, and then we can kind of just hang for the rest of the stream. I was thinking maybe we could kind of wrap it early, but like I'm feeling okay. My voice hasn't completely failed yet, even through all of my wacky rants. So I'm gonna bounce two of these because it's just other Pixel leaks and rumors and stuff. I mean, like, we're a little bit more than a week away from the official reveal. Pixel, I am most anxiously excited for this year. Like, I'm the most anxious for the Duo 2. I'm the most anxiously excited for the Pixel 6. It is a necessary component in competition. Google, I mean, maybe only for the second time in the run of Pixel phones, really making their own phone. With the Pixel 1, Pixel 2, those were more HTC and LG devices. Pixel 3 was kind of a transition as they were incorporating the HTC team into the Pixel hardware division. And then the Pixel 4, I feel, is like the first true Google-built Pixel. Pixel 5 is obviously kind of a treading water kind of a phone, just to keep the Pixel brand alive under extraordinary circumstances for the year while they built Tensor. So Pixel 6 is literally Gen 2 of real Pixel flagship phone built completely by Google, and now we're also getting the competitive the competitive edge of Google making their own SoC. There's a lot riding on Pixel 6. So a bunch of these like leaks and rumors, and how Brandon's been going crazy on like getting all this information. I still feel like leaks and rumors suck all the fun out of reveals and products, and I'm anxious to see what Google actually has to say. Because this might be also the biggest claims that Google has ever made for a phone. And I want to see what it is that they're trying to do to live up to those claims. In the same way that I'm going to rag on a Samsung and call your phone an Ultra, I want to see what is it about your everyday epic smartphone really does accomplish epic things every day, right? So the one I do want to point out here, though, the one I do want to highlight, click this in, Google Pixel 6 teasers confirm 5 years of Android security updates. This is written up by John Fingus. And looking at some of the marketing materials and some of the things that have leaked out, this is maybe one of the more important aspects of competition. And I don't mean that just in terms of Google's making a phone, that's competition. The whole relationship in Android land is extremely complex between the phone manufacturer, where they source their parts from, the carriers they do business with, and the end consumer. It's always been the most difficult aspect of Android devices is examining that chain of relationships, especially here in North America. One of the parts that gets, one of the issues that consumers find in that interrupted support conversation is the company that makes the chipsets, the SoCs, the processors. Qualcomm has a significant amount of influence over the window of support that different devices can enjoy. I feel there's been a lot of pressure on Qualcomm to start opening up those windows a little bit longer. From the corporate side, Android has a certification process for business grade devices. And it's funny, but like the Snapdragon 660 is one of those chipsets that has this ridiculously long support window because of industrial use. So like rugged handhelds, like the scanning barcode readers, all of those old like Windows handhelds that got replaced from like the pocket PC days, you know, like your UPS driver walks up and you sign something, and that used to be powered by like Windows CE. Now that is, a lot of those are flipping to Android. the only reason those companies would switch to this to this new hardware is if Qualcomm could guarantee much longer support windows. Hold on one second here. Short story, incredibly long. With Google making Tensor, I feel the most critical aspect of this is not the major operating system updates. It's the security patching. So I would expect a Pixel to still get like 3-4 full Android operating system updates. That's not the issue. It's the support beyond that. With consumers really trying to hold onto their phones longer and longer, we're seeing that support, that that ownership window lengthen. It's the security patching that I feel becomes the most critical. Even if you don't get Android 17, if your phone is still in operation, you should still benefit from bug fixes and security patching. And especially like new features don't go to the operating system. New features go through, what I forget what it's called now, the Android Intelligence System or something like that. But it used to be Google Play Services. You know, you would update the phone directly free of the manufacturer's involvement. So that's the critical aspect. And I know like Apple gets a lot of credit, like, well, you know, your iPhone's going to get 5 years of updates too. But Apple doesn't detach security patching from operating system OTAs. So especially as your iPhone is getting to like 5 years older, yes, you are on the newest version of iOS. And you probably do get a few cosmetic and aesthetic changes, but you're not getting all the new features. You're not getting all of the new software that's going to the new iPhones. The new iPhones get all of the new features, all of the new operating system benefits, all of the newness. The older phones are essentially just on a track for mostly getting bug fixes and security patches. And that's what we're lacking in Android land. I've got phones on my shelf that are 2 years old that are dead. For new software, right? That's unacceptable. That is not okay, and we need to be calling out manufacturers that are not living up to their obligations. You sell a product to a consumer. I feel like that is a business partnership now, and you have an obligation for that kind of support. I mean, and it's funny too, because like, you know, LG's dead, and I'm still getting security patches. V60, Velvet, Wing. Like, I'm not expecting crazy great newness out of operating system updates, but LG is still saying like, hey, you're probably still using V50s and G8s, so I guess we'll get around to security patches eventually. You know, like, it's crazy. So Google, finally, with their proper second generation, fully Google-built, premium tier, flagship phone, all these stupid adjectives that we need to use to describe this stuff, making a commitment to say, hey, now we have greater control. We have greater control over the manufacturing of this phone. We have greater control over the longevity of the SoC. We can make a more public commitment to longer term support is absolutely critical. It's a competitive point that drives a Samsung to keep up with their security obligations and their security promises. It will hopefully inform, maybe we do need to spend a little bit more on Xiaomi. Maybe Xiaomi's current business model, where you can get crazy great hardware at reduced prices, but you have to put up with some software shenanigans to get that crazy great hardware. And we've got a competitive balancing point against that. There are a bunch of phones out there that you can spend very, very little to get amazing hardware, but maybe that's not in the consumer's best interest over years of ownership. And this, Google needs to lead that conversation. They've been absent from that conversation basically since the inception of Android. They've been trying to say like, well, we just make the OS and it's up to the manufacturers to compete. The manufacturers aren't going to compete. They're all going to descend to the lowest support costs possible to make the most profit out of every phone. So now Google has the ability to shake that conversation up. And that to me becomes one of the most critically exciting aspects of Pixel. Not Pixel 6, embargo week review, oh my gosh, I went outside and took a terribly composed photo of a fire hydrant off my porch. Look at the amazing HDR colors. The Pixel 6 conversation gets rad into like year three. And that to me becomes the most important part of this. Now we've got to hold Google up to that standard. They've been doing real well with the Pixel A series. I feel they've brought some real interesting improvements to the Pixel 5. Pixel 6 has to last. Now it's really on Google because they don't have the excuse, well, we didn't make the SoC, so we couldn't support it. It's go time. Oh, there's a bunch of things going on here in the chat. I don't even know where. Oh, from Tiger Kim. I mean, literally, like, the most recent comment. I like the move. It forces other manufacturers to step their game with security updates. You know, it's Baseball Super, it is go time. Agreed. I feel like Google probably won't ever get to the relationship Microsoft has with their OEMs and ODMs, where Microsoft is in charge of Windows and other companies can just kind of put out drivers and packages and stuff to install software and stuff. I don't think Google can get there with Android. I really don't. I feel like Google won't be able to lock that up until we see them switch to like Fuchsia, you know, if that is even the plan, or if they can find some way of combining Chrome OS and Android OS, whatever speculation might be happening out there. But what they can do, and the track that they've been on, is migrating more and more of the aspects of Android that are responsible for security, for exploits, for app installations, you know, some of the things we've been talking about in this podcast so far. If Google can kind of regain more of the control of that apparatus, then I think they can do a much better job of directly supporting any manufacturer's phone. It takes some of the support concerns off of their OEM partners. And I feel like that's a significant consumer benefit. The fun side is when you get a new service like Nearby Share, or when you get like a live caption, that goes to the phone through Google services. You don't have to wait for a carrier or for a manufacturer OTA to get those new features. That never happens on an iPhone. You don't get new features, you just get the security patches and the bug fixes and the updates. But like Nearby Share, that was flipped on all the way back to like Android 6, you know, like that's a better process. But we still have to close a significant gap on other bug fixing and security patching problems. And I feel like the last two Android updates, last two Android operating system updates have helped empower Google to regain more control over those subsystems, but we still have a ways to go. And Android 12, I think, is going to be another positive step in that direction. Sorry, I'm rambling and I just lost the thread of the chat again. From Copacash, I mean, again, this is a good trend. Xiaomi recently announced 3 years of security updates. This is a trend in the right direction because I am way less familiar with Xiaomi, but it has been one of the consistent concerns of their phones is like, I got this really powerful, really cheap phone, and I got like a couple early just software updates to improve like, you know, apps crashing or other performance issues. And then Xiaomi can go really long stretches with like no direct consumer relationship, no direct support from that point. So making those kinds of commitments, you know, Google's going to come out and say, hey, 5 years of security updates. Now there is, like, if you're thinking like, hey, I want to try and hold on to my phone for longer. Let's see if I can push my phone to 3 years. Now a Xiaomi has a competitive conversation there. You think you're going to hold on to your phone for 3 years, we'll support you. That's a perfect window, right? That should be like the conversation we engage with going from manufacturer to consumer. That's exactly why we need a leader, not Samsung. Samsung doesn't make Android. It's why we need Google to really step up and run this conversation. So Russ is saying he's seen the LG G8 has Android 11 on some variants. It's not on mine. The T-Mobile one has not fired up an update there. And from Pakistan, it would be fun to see Fairphone or Volafone in some gadget guy's hands. I really want to get my hands on a Fairphone. It looks, and especially this newest one looks really cool. And I don't disassemble as much. I used to do a lot more like PC building stuff with Newegg, but I just want to get a Fairphone to like take it apart. So I'm very anxious to see if I can get my hands on one. And lastly, I just want to highlight this because we're talking about support, longevity, repairability, how Apple is terrible at all of those things, but they market like they're amazing at those things, and they're all about the environment, but they're going to triple your packaging and shipping waste. I don't know if Mark's still listening, but I feel like he needs to hear this on my podcast. sorry, that was snarky. The video that I think excited a lot of us, those of us who are on the pre-order, I am getting more and more anxious to play with a Steam Deck. I want one so bad. I'm still crazy angry that Valve servers were struggling so hard on pre-order day because they said, like, oh, your account is too new. And you're like, I signed up for a Steam account like when Steam launched. You know, oh, you need to buy something with your Steam account and then we can verify you. And it's like, I've got a library of games. You see all the games that I've never played. Give me my pre-order. So the folks at Valve did a teardown of the Steam Deck. And I really appreciate that they did this. It's taking a lot of the speculation out of, will this be repairable? What about the thumbsticks? If there's going to be drift? There was when Steam Deck was first announced, there's like a 64 gig model and it's in like an eMMC, and then there's going to be an M.2 drive model. Fancy words for different types of storage. But people were saying like, oh, you know what I'll do? I'll buy the less expensive version with slower, cheaper, smaller storage, and then I'll buy my own SSD to upgrade it. So when we see in this teardown, and they're taking all these things apart and they're showing you the innards and how like the cooling hardware connects to the various components and how amazingly compact all of this is for it being kind of a portable computer that fits in your hands, almost Switch style, it wasn't to say, the video hinges a lot on, we're going to show you how to take it apart, but we don't recommend that you do it. And I appreciate that. Totally fair. But I liked that as they were describing some of those components, you know, they're saying, hey, it's not really designed to be user accessible. It's not really designed to be user replaceable. And we have picked very specific SSDs to fit certain power and thermal envelopes. That's a really critical piece of information. It's not to say you can't. And I disagree with their idea that, oh, you shouldn't take this thing apart. I want people to not be afraid of, like, opening the case and seeing what's inside their magic rectangle that glows, right? But it is critically important to understand, you go and buy a Steam Deck, and you get the cheapest one because you can upgrade the storage, you could significantly compromise performance if you're not picking the right components to satisfy what this device was built around. So this is so much more valuable than like, you know, a destruction porn teardown. You know, like I don't need to see someone hold a lighter up to the screen of the Steam Deck. I want to know what's going on in there. This was like to the degree that like iFixit does their teardowns. You know, the real white glove, you know, softbox, you know, like that's exactly the kind of component teardown that I want to see. And to know, hey, if I game on this thing hard and I destroy these analog sticks, I need to know that, like, it's not like those sticks aren't soldered to a main board and I'll never be able to replace them. If I don't do the replacement myself, I still want to know that if I take it to a company that can do proper repair work, that they'll be able to get in there and do this right. and that they'll have the parts and the accessibility and the diagramming to make sure that they can repair this thing. So that it's, I don't want to get a Steam Deck and know if I give it to you, you can't fix it, you're just going to give me back a refurb. I want to give it to you and get my Steam Deck back and not have it end up as e-waste in a landfill. And that's what's critically important about what's going on here. Now, I need to highlight, in the Steam Deck teardown, in the presentation, they're very anxious. Like, if you take out these screws are sealed in a very specific way, you could compromise the structural integrity of the Steam Deck. I doubt that. I really doubt that Valve has built the Steam Deck to such a tolerance that a specific filling on a screw is going to compromise the outer shell of the Steam Deck. So I feel like some of their warnings are very, like, doom and gloom. Like, there's a lot of FUD, you know, fear. Oh no, if you are not careful disassembling the Steam Deck, you could rupture the battery and that could end your life. And that's like a part of their teardown. Like, you could die taking apart your Steam Deck. If that were true, I would feel no Steam Decks should be sold, right? Let's say your Steam Deck takes a drop. If the tolerances are that tight that potential damage to the battery could kill you, then I really think you shouldn't sell it. I really think, like, you, that's dangerous, right? That's scary. Who was it? Oh, Rossman, of course, Luis Rossman. He was watching some of their teardown video. I didn't watch his whole stream on it, but he was like, "Let me show you." In my repair shop, I once damaged a battery. This is what it looked like. The only way a battery could kill you is if, like, you have no survival instinct. So, like, let's say you decide to open up your Steam Deck, and here's the battery, and you puncture this, and then instead of trying to get away from it as the battery ignites, you picked the Steam Deck up and you shoved it into your nose, then yes, that could kill you. That would probably kill you. But you would have to take action to pick up a burning piece of technology and then not try to escape from it or get a fire extinguisher or get away from it. You would have to choose to succeed in losing your life there. Paul Puri, if you open your Steam Deck, your family will die. Happy streaming! and from Fat Parodies, again, I mean, like, I think the greatest danger... Oh, where is the comment? There is. I think the greatest danger for battery catching fire is catching the house on fire because it's too close to something flammable. Totally appreciated. And so when I take things apart, now I've moved to... I've got, like, this little student desk. I can move it to the middle of my office. I did just a little bit of work on my Nook. I need to get a new case for my Nook. I don't like the case that the Nook ships with. But now, like, I do take that into consideration. I've got a fire extinguisher just on the other side of the door, just outside the office, that I can pick up at any time. And it's a pretty beefy one. And I try not to do things like immediately under my acoustic blankets or over by my curtains or my blinds. Like, you think about that stuff. And you look at, like, repair shops. They've got, like, wide open benches and workspaces and like microscopes, and they're really trying to make sure that they're isolating the product from the rest of the environment. There's so much that I appreciate, and just seeing how Valve has packed all of the gear into the Steam Deck. It's exciting for two reasons. One, that it's real. It's finally, like, I want it so bad. We're getting so close to these things actually shipping. I'm just crazy. Please, 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 grabby hands, grabby hands. Two, that they will hopefully be addressing right to repair with the design of this product and for future generations of it. I want it to be fixable. Even if it's not upgradable, I want it to be fixable. And then, hopefully this is a template. Hopefully, you know, Valve is saying, like, hey, we can make portable PC gaming more accessible, less expensive. And other manufacturers, like, I want to see Dell take a stab at something like this. Maybe HP can get back into gaming with something like this. I mean, not get back into, obviously they've got gaming PCs. But I mean, like, making a purpose-built portable gaming rig, and they can look at, well, the Steam Deck is doing this, the Dell is doing this, Lenovo has, like, a flippy-foldy yoga version of this, and we can do something else. And if they're all kind of built with different ideas, we'll have competition. You know, we'll have a console market, but built on catalogs of gaming for PCs. That, to me, is phenomenally exciting. Bringing PC gaming into the world of people who would not blink an eye picking up a Nintendo Switch. That's empowering. You know, I opted for the top-of-the-line Steam Deck, and it's way cheaper than any gaming PCs out there. You know, it's making me salivate. I want so bad. Sorry, I just went off on a whole bunch of stuff. Oh, people are talking about the Escobar. I'm not okay. You know, Escobar is just such a cynical attempt at getting any kind of media coverage. You know, this is a family of people who, you know, came to wealth through very questionable means. I'm not okay joking about Escobar. It's not funny. It's really frustrating. You're like, oh, Escobar phone. And you're like, that's, you know, I feel like a lot of people around the world, especially in Central and South America, probably have very specific ideas on that name. So it's a bummer that it's kind of casually shrugged off in the tech landscape as like the punchline to some silly joke. Dave Burns, can the Steam Deck double as a space heater? I think not. You know, us using Snapdragon 888s unite with warm hands. let me get this out of the way here. So, what do we got? We got like 20 minutes here, maybe a little less than 20 minutes. Oh, Ted Talks Tech. Hey, Ted, what's up? Subscribed with Prime. Thank you so much. I appreciate you jumping on and supporting the channel. Some good stuff there. Hold on. Gabaletta just wrote a book. Let's see what Gabaletta has to say. I understand it's cheaper and it streamlines the manufacturing process by using self-tapping screws. My issue with them is that over time they lose grip due to case flexing, vibration, temperature fluctuations, etc., because they don't have any type of thread locker. If you open it and demonstrably reduce the ability for those screws to hold the case together because they retap the already existing thread, causing them to spin. Oh, okay, I see what you're saying, because they'll spin in place. So that is absolutely a concern, but I don't believe that's what they're describing in the Valve video, because in the Valve video, they're talking about like literally the structural integrity of dropping it. So they show this like, hey, we took the screws out. Oh, I got to mute that so I don't get a thing. And then they show it dropping on a workbench. That is a different kind of structural integrity to what you're describing. And especially in terms of long-term repairability, the ability to reseat or rethread. You know, yes, you are totally correct. If you take out one of these tapping screws, put it together, I totally feel what you're saying. The way they present it in the video is, you know, you take out these screws and the case will crack and your handheld will not survive bumps and bruises and small drops. And that's a different issue. That is a completely different concern. So yes, they talked about those things, but what is the visual that they're using? They're instilling fear in opening it and repairing it by talking about like the performance testing they've done on dropping it and smashing it with a hammer. The screws are not contributing to that idea of durability, but their presentation of taking the screws out immediately shows drop performance. That is a different conversation, and I do not believe that their choice of screw is directly contributing to what they're showing in that sequence. Okay. So it's October. While we wrap up kind of the last 10 minutes here, as we kind of close out the podcast, the stream, it's a little less of like, you know, like a tech centric or a tech focus, but, I'm a huge horror film fan. This is kind of like my, you know, the big holiday for me for my favorite movies. My wife does not like the scary. She does like the funny and the spooky, but she does not like the scary. And I just got into a thread with some of my other family members, and it was just kind of funny seeing it like across the board. Like my brother and his girlfriend were interested in trying to find like some more legit horror films, while my sister is maybe looking more for themes, but not the scary. And then my mom and dad are kind of going back and forth on like, what movies are we going to watch this October? And my dad really wants to do like a marathon of the Halloween films. And my mom is kind of like, well, maybe like Trick or Treat is more our speed. And so it's just kind of really interesting, you know, like how we put the flavors of these themes together. From Halloween to Christmas, especially as we kind of pass through Thanksgiving, as we get to the end of the year, there's a consideration. You know, we're ending something and we're about to begin something. And I know it's just arbitrary dates on a calendar, and these things could be, you know, stapled to any time of the year. They're not necessarily inherently special, but we have imbued them with something meaningful. And there's something to me as we get through Halloween and then into like Dia de los Muertos, where I get really reflective. Horror films do this thing to me where, you know, the fun of the horror film is like, oh, and by the way, that didn't happen to me and I'm still alive. Sigh of relief. You know, in a really safe fantasy kind of context, I get to examine my own mortality. And then into Dia de los Muertos, I get to kind of remember my family. You know, my daughter is really interested in putting together an ofrenda, and so that we can put up photos of our loved ones. And those stories continue, you know, from my great-grandparents to my grandparents to my mom, my dad, to me, to my daughter, and we get to pass these things along. In fact, what she wants to do is to make a digital ofrenda, because I've got so many phones, and so we'll plug them all in, and we'll put a photo of each family member, like, on each phone, and so, like, we can just turn it on, and it'll all be glowing and lit up, and she's kind of amazing for a six-year-old. I thought that was an amazing idea, so we got to try and pull it off. So, to me, it was fascinating. I feel like there's a lot of fun. Horror and comedy dovetail each other. Really good horror and really good comedy are both built on a similar idea. Can you build up tension in a way that the release is satisfying? And, you know, for comedy, the release is trying to get a laugh. And for horror, the release is trying to get a scare. But genuinely, if you mistime horror, you end up with comedy. And if you mistime comedy, you end up with something really cringe and like potentially anxious creating. And to me, it's just kind of wonderful examining that through the context of film and why some of these things are so effective. So, I'm a fan of some of the quieter, more psychological, torturing aspects of good horror. You know, when we look at things like the Halloween series, I'm a little less into the later films that become more of the tropes that Halloween created and become more paint-by-numbers slasher films. But the first two Halloween films are built in quieter, more subtle, slower burning kinds of structures. The first Halloween film, and especially when you watch it today, is not a good slasher movie. It's the prototype of a slasher movie. And that to me gets me really excited. Before we had figured out what like a crazy dude in a mask with a machete killing teenagers was supposed to resemble, Halloween built up sort of a structure for it, but didn't really satisfy that structure. Same thing, you know, like with Friday the 13th. The first one, to me, is a critical example of starting the trope, but not doing a very good job of satisfying the trope. And then, of course, every subsequent Friday the 13th is a dude in a hockey mask with a machete, you know, slaughtering teenagers by the score. And they've become our modern-day morality tales. They've become our sort of life-affirming tales. There's so many different ways that we can explore this, and each monster becomes a metaphor for some ill in our society. You know, zombie movies, where a zombie movie can act like a force of nature. A zombie movie can literally be discussing something like disease and outbreak and contagion. A zombie movie can do really warped things, like take a film like Pawnee Pool, where the zombie virus is a mental virus that's spread through, you know, a radio DJ's broadcast. We can use these different platforms, we can use these different genres to discuss and to exemplify some of the ills facing our society. Vampires can be lusty, vampires can be carnal. Zombies can be nature, zombies can be the human condition, zombies can be survival. Ghosts, for me, it's all about letting go. You know, really good ghost stories are those stories that depict sort of the idea of holding too tight to a memory or being kind of consumed by a tragic event in your past. So it's all of these different things. And then we get into the fun things and some of the schlock and some of the creature features and some of the jump scares. My wife just got me the entire collection of Rec. You know, probably the first Rec film, probably the most functionally successful found footage film. And blending elements of the immediacy and the intimacy of found footage against a really taut, well-told zombie-style tray, 5G cause zombies. Allgreg, Night of the Living Dead. And again, if you haven't seen Night of the Living Dead in 1968, it's a groundbreaking film. It completely redefined what zombies were in society. They don't even say zombie once in the film. It was originally supposed to be called Night of the Flesh Eaters and has very little to do with previous zombie stories, which are built on like Afro-Cuban, sort of in the peninsula, stories of like corruption and torpor. You know, like what a zombie was before 1968 was very different to what a zombie was after 1968. So Simon says Hypno, Ernest goes to Camp Crystal Lake. So I, DTNL, Juan, it's nighttime here. Stop talking about horror movies. Maria and I had this conversation. We were talking about cosmic horror. Movies from like Event Horizon to Hellraiser. And how those haven't been very satisfying to me, because I feel cosmic horror in a very Cthulhu kind of way is almost impossible to depict in a movie. And like Marie and I were getting into it real deep, and I could see like into the conversation, oh, I might be upsetting my wife because she does not like horror. Oh, and from Coppercash, Night of the Living Dead is a cult classic. Not only is it a cult classic, it fell into the public domain because of the shenanigans of changing the name of the movie. So it is totally legal for you to go to archive.org. And archive.org has a high-quality Blu-ray 1080p rip of that movie that looks fantastic. It looks great. It's one of the best transfers of that movie outside of, I think, the HBO. Like, I think there's a version on HBO Max that looks a little cleaner. It's a little brighter. You can tell, like, maybe they found a better film print and cleaned it up a bit. But the free archive.org Night of the Living Dead is fantastic. Oh, Dave Burns, cosmic horror, eh? Yeah, I love reading cosmic horror. But I think it runs into those issues. You know, you're trying to imagine an ancient evil of our sense memories tapping into something larger than our universe and older than our galaxy. And I don't know that there's a good way to depict that on screen. You know, it's like the problem of It. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book, but the ending of It is often held up as something a little unsatisfying. You know, you spend all this time building up this cosmic, horrific entity, and then the final depiction of it is a little bit of a letdown. And that's my big problem. Like, cosmic horror needs to kind of be up to my own imagination. And like, what's depicted in a movie like Event Horizon or the Cenobites from Hellraiser are too literal. It's too literal a depiction of cosmic horror. So it doesn't scare me. It actually, I think, you go and watch the first Hellraiser film and you're like, oh my God, this is hilarious. To me, it becomes really fun, funny schlock. It doesn't really live up to the kind of imagery that people expect when they see, you know, people in weird S&M garb with like nails sticking out of their head. That's not scary. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to take a...
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, so Dave is also saying also the Last Door series is a great cosmic horror adventure game. I think cosmic horror could work better in a video game context because of the interactive qualities of it. I think the more passive viewing experience, cosmic horror can't leave enough up to my imagination if you're showing me what's scary. I think that's why a movie like It Follows is more effective for me, is because the monster in It Follows, we never really get to see it. We only get to see what it hides itself as or what it disguises itself as. We never get a good grasp on what the thing is. And those are the movies to me that are most effective. What is that low budget? I think it's the same guy who just did Midnight Mass, which was okay. I didn't like the ending of Midnight Mass on Netflix. I think the movie's Absentia. The anxiety-inducing elements of Absentia are very much tied to the things we don't see. And that to me becomes... That to me becomes the driving motivation of a movie that does scare the pee out of me a little bit. I think effective international flavors of that. Like, this is the perfect time of year if you haven't seen the original Let the Right One In. Using vampires as a centerpiece for talking about corruption and abuse is like a wonderful pairing. And the movie is so quiet. And the movie is so slow, and it's so subtle, and it builds up, and it almost gives you some hope for the characters that are involved, and it's just such like a beautifully shot representation of a vampire movie. Let Me In, the American remake of it, is way more deliberate. It's not a bad movie. It's actually a very good vampire movie, but it doesn't have that same sense of subtlety. There's like less nuance. Everything is dirtier and grungier from the beginning, kind of giving up the gag on what the story really unfolds around. Tech Love and Mama, I just started Midnight Mass, only 3 episodes so far, so it seems pretty good. I'm going to shut up because I have very strong feelings about Midnight Mass, but I feel it's a property people need to finish on their own terms. I made the mistake of reading some editorials from people about it just before we got to the last 2 episodes, and I feel that sucked some of the fun of what they do accomplish out of that story. I can't say I enjoyed it overall, but I really want people to consume it on their own terms. And I think there's going to be a wide spectrum of reactions to Midnight Mass. So, on my list, absolutely, I'm going to be checking out Trick or Treat. That's one of the fun films that Marie does like. It's a horror anthology. It's four short stories that loosely kind of influence each other. But it's such a delicious blend of Halloween. The movie Trick or Treat takes place on Halloween. It's maybe the most Halloween film that's ever been made because it's about Halloween and the myths and legends of Halloween, depicted in four kind of hilarious little vignettes. There's so much comedy sort of infused. It's this love letter to Halloween. So Trick or Treat's high on our list. For me, one of my favorite traditions, almost every year, I have to watch The Omen, the original Omen with Gregory Peck, is just a stellar example. Richard Donner produced a movie that is about a cult and like, you know, the end days, potentially, you know, like the revelations. It's Bible, it's heavy, it's thick. It's kind of a world-bending adventure. But it's so grounded that you get to the end of the movie and you're like, wow, Gregory Peck is put into an impossible decision. And I feel like that is so effective. The special effects aren't great. You know, the makeup effects, you know, when people die on camera, like it doesn't hold up as well to how sophisticated movie making has gotten. But that's not why you watch The Omen. You watch The Omen because it's classic actors at the top of their game. It's got one of the Doctor Who's in it, Patrick Troughton. I mean, it's so good. It is such an amazing feat of filmmaking. And then we're kind of struggling with some of the other movies that we might be watching. Marie floated Gremlins, which I know is often more of like a Christmas movie, like it takes place at Christmas, but the tone and the setting and you know the hilarity of that movie might make it a good fit for us for Halloween time. And then one of the other films that we usually turn to is Ghostbusters, just for good spooky elements. You know, it's a movie about ghosts. I ain't afraid of no ghosts, but, you know, it's a comedy, you know? So again, it kind of takes the pressure off Marie. Marie is very sensitive to, like, really effective psychological scares. So I lost, you know, the ability to take her to horror films after showing her It Follows. That one freaked her out bad. The Ring. I still to this day submit that Marie was probably more scared by The Ring because she didn't watch it. We were in the movie theater together. We were pretty new into our relationship. And she spent the whole movie like my arm around her, but like shoving her face into my armpit. So she was hearing everything that was going on, but she wasn't watching it. And I feel like if she had seen the last sequence in The Ring, it probably would have made her chuckle. Like it wouldn't have scared her, but she's just listening to it. She's got an extremely vivid imagination that I think freaked her out way worse than what the movie actually can accomplish. Like, I don't think it's as scary as what we can think, as what we can think about for that kind of a situation. But I'm really excited. You know, my Lex is wanting to watch the Hotel Transylvania movies because they have monsters in them. And then Monsters, Inc. We might watch, you know, do a family viewing of Monsters, Inc. because it's Halloween time and monsters. And like Boo wears a costume to dress up as a monster. So I think Lex is totally on point there. But then I'm kind of curious, like what other kind of movies? Like I saw someone was saying Trolls 2. It's a great movie to kind of make fun of. The other films, like the Freddy films. I love the classic, the original Nightmare on Elm Street. Like that is just so satisfying, old school, lower budget, practical effects horror for its time. Awesome Possum saying, I can't do horror. I scream louder than my daughter. So the thing is, there's the fun of Halloween, though. you know, Halloween has a very specific vibe and a very, very specific flavor. So if you can't do legit horror, that's why I recommend movies like Trick or Treat, because it's about Halloween. It's a movie for Halloween. There is some tension. There are some spooky bits, but there are sequences that are like intellectually funny. Dylan Baker is amazing in that movie. The character he plays is just absolutely incredible. But then there are also some sequences that are just straight up slapstick. And good slapstick is hard to come by. So the tension is created by all of these spooky bits, but then the payoff is like a really good pratfall. Or like, you know, smashing with a hammer. You know, like a movie like Evil Dead 2. You know, there's like a whole part in Evil Dead 2 where Ash's hand is possessed. I'm not really giving up crazy spoilers here. And he has to get rid of it. That's why Ash has like a chainsaw that he can connect to the, you know, his arm. But there's a wacky hilarity. You know, he's smashing plates over his head because his hand is possessed, and his hand will grab him by the scruff of his neck and flip him over. And he and it's really Bruce Campbell doing these pratfalls because they can't afford stunt people for Evil Dead 2. But there's this whole sequence where he's out in the tool shed. Something horrific happens in the tool shed, and he goes stumbling back out to the main house, and he stops and he thinks. And he turns back and he puts this teeny little ineffective latch back on the door to lock the tool shed. And then he goes stumbling like in this like state of shock back into the house. And it's all those little moments. Like, the movie is not functionally scary, but the scary bits build up this tension. And then something as small as putting the little latch lock back on the tool shed crack me up. The release of that is pure hilarious. And that's the kind of stuff that I absolutely love about, you know, the themes of a good Halloween film. Same thing with Ghostbusters. The comedy of Ghostbusters is built up by some genuinely spooky premises. I don't know how you pluralize premise. I don't think you do. Genuinely spooky setups, but then pay off through the impeccable comedic timing of the performers that are in there. The comedy works because the movie lets you amp up a little bit because of the scary, and then the payoff is a good laugh. From a DTNL, I hate horror, period. Maybe Ghostbusters and Monsters, Inc. Oh, Allgreg, Little Monsters with Fred Savage. I haven't watched that movie in probably decades. From Build Monkey, Over the Garden Wall is a fantastic autumnal animated miniseries. Simon says, Hypnoa, Farewell to Arms. From Tech Love and Mama, for my youngest, I loved watching Paranorman, Monster House, and Coraline. I'm anxious to see if Lex can hang with Coraline. I haven't watched it since it was originally out, and I feel she's probably still just a little too young for it. I need to rewatch it and see, like, gauge whether or not she's into it. But things like Coco. Not for Halloween, but for Dia de los Muertos. Like, it just waterworks. Like, I can't get to the end of Coco not sobbing like a tiny little baby. But that's the right movie to kind of watch around this time of year. And my daughter loves Coco. For Mr. Malignance, this is absolutely true. Original Evil Dead had better suspenseful moments. It got more slapsticky as it went. So Evil Dead 1 is low budget. It's amazing that these nerds finished a movie. But it's actually kind of creepier and scarier because the special effects are so bad. But because the special effects are so bad, it's kind of held up as this, like, loving horror failure funny film. Evil Dead 2 comes around, and they have more of a budget to work with. The special effects get way better. There's even that one camera drop sequence, Bruce Campbell lying on his back, and it's a reverse shot as the camera, like, gets pulled back up. Absolutely incredible. And like the floating evil cam as it moves through the house is absolutely impeccable. But Evil Dead 2, I feel, is the perfect balance of scary stuff to funny stuff. And then Army of Darkness just goes full madcap, zany, wacky, TV-produced style comedy. And I love all three movies, but I love them for each specific flavor that that they represent. And like then you get into the TV show, like Ash vs. the Evil Dead is actually kind of a fun show, but it is definitely not serious, scary in any regard. Oh, Mr. Malignant's Nightbreed. Man, I haven't watched Nightbreed in years. Oh, I need to jump on that. Oh, and from Trey, Coco and the Book of Life. We just saw the Book of Life. Yeah, I was surprised. I liked it better than I thought I would. Oh, that's a good one. Tech Lab and Mama, Frankenweenie. You know, I think that would be right up Lex's alley because she does like spooky Frankenstein-y kinds of things, like the monsters in Hotel Transylvania. Yeah, that one's a good one. I need to take another look at that one. Oh, that's a good idea. I've forgotten Frankenweenie. Some people talking back and forth about Coraline and how Neil Gaiman stories get real heavy. The feels, I remember the feels. I don't remember the movie as well. From Baseball Super, my friend just recommended me Coco today. Eerie coincidence. So there's nothing horror or Halloween about it, which is what's so beautiful. It's what's so delicious. So few mainstream movies like that written about my people. Such a wonderful celebration of a tradition that I only as I've gotten older have I really come to appreciate. And I always like would roll my eyes at like, you know, my grandmother setting up an altar with photos and stuff. And you know, here comes this movie where that's literally the plot of the movie is a little kid like, why should we care about this ofrenda? And what I love is it deals with mortality and memory and family without getting ghastly. You know, like I think there's a tendency to look at the depictions of like skulls and the papeles picados in Dia de los Muertos and like imbue it with something darker than what it really is. You know, topics of death and mortality are dark, scary, dark. And Coco finds like a life and a vibrance. So it's not a good Halloween movie if you're expecting the scares and the spooks and stuff. But it is such a wonderful kind of love letter to a tradition that I don't think is well understood, not even well understood in my family. You know, especially us coming from New Mexico, we have a different flavor of being Hispanic and, you know, Latin than I feel like, you know, people from Mexico or especially people here in Southern California. The New Mexican flavor of that is very European and different. And it's funny to try and think about those permutations of being Hispanic. But it's something now that like, as I've gotten older and before I saw Coco, as I've been getting older, like, oh, this is kind of important to me. And the stories of our family are important to me and saving the media, like getting to show my daughter, her grandparents dancing as teenagers on 8mm footage. You know, my grandfather's dad shot 8mm home movies of my grandfather and my grandmother dancing as teenagers. I get to show my daughter that. That's ridiculous. That's amazing. That's tangible and that's real and that's history and it's life, you know? So Coco totally feeds into this like passion project I've got of like saving all the family media and being the archivist for our family stories. And like, I might set up a second NAS just as a backup for nothing but like the family photos and videos and film transfers and movie reels and just like trying to protect it all. So yeah, it's good times. I highly recommend Coco. Simon says, Hypno, I watched The Dead Don't Die recently. It was awful. Is that the one that was Jarmusch? Like small town, it's got, what's his name? Is it Adam Driver? if that's the one, I think I'm with you. The movie was too clever for its own good. And I don't like self-aware from the author, where, like, even in passing, characters are referencing the script of the movie that they're in. If that's the one, I did not enjoy it. And again, for how much I love zombie movies when they're clever or when they're really well executed, that one to me felt very cynical. And again, sort of using the zombie trope as a way to skewer filmmaking, which doesn't work for me. It was ineffective. From Baseball Super, I definitely do have the technological equipment to be the family archivist. From Kenox, are you trying to get me in trouble? Hold on, I gotta put this one up. Sorry, excuse me. Juan, do you lay your enchiladas flat like lasagna? I heard it's common in New Mexico. Sorry, off topic. That is one of the most visceral debates in our family as it pertains to food. I feel there is a methodology for stacked enchiladas versus rolled enchiladas dependent on the color of chili that you're using, the heat that you're going for, the quantity of cheese that you'll be employing, and the fillings that you're going to be putting into the enchiladas. So there is we do a traditional Thanksgiving dinner in my family. Big old turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes. We don't put a lot of New Mexican flair on that, but we've got our whole collection of side dishes and stuff. The day after Thanksgiving, we do a very specific rolled enchilada with the leftover turkey, a ton of cheese, and a green chili sauce that you can only make with New Mexican, Coloradan green chili. And this is like our family tradition. Thanksgiving, very traditional. Day after Thanksgiving, New Mexican like crazy. But it doesn't work if you try and do that as a stacked enchilada. And there's something about the gaminess of the turkey with the green chili. Like, it needs to be rolled and contained in the tortilla. It can't be stacked in the tortilla and sliced like lasagna. But there are some fillings I want that lasagna comfort foodie feel, and the only way to do that is with a stacked enchilada. So there's no way for me to properly answer that without putting this podcast into another hour of food discussion, which we can try and do. You know, like, let's try and save that for an after Thanksgiving podcast, and I'll break it down and we'll go there. But yeah, there are some funny New Mexican traditions, and especially because as people came up through South America, my family coming in through Central Mexico, there's a lot of Italian influence. Genetically, my mom's dad's side of the family is mostly from the Mediterranean. When we look back, like 14 and 15 generations, I'm 14th or 15th generation on this continent. My mom's dad's side of the family, heavily influenced by Italian and Mediterranean. My mom's mom's side of the family, way more focused on the Sephardic Jews in the Iberian Peninsula from Portugal and from Spain. And then we also have ribbons of like Middle Eastern and Lebanese. So all of those get mixed together in Michoacan, and then the Spaniards just kind of march up and settle in what becomes New Mexico. All of our food is ridiculously influenced by the trompo, like those big meat skewers, stacked pastas. Well, we can't make those same kinds of stacked pastas with the materials that we have here in the Americas. We start making them out of corn, you know? So a stacked enchilada from New Mexico is heavily influenced by Italians that were heavily influenced by Spaniards and then kind of went marching up through all of that. You know, it's kind of an interesting way to kind of wrap all this conversation up, because today is Indigenous Peoples Day, and my family is so heavily influenced by the Spaniards that came, the conquistadors that came, some of the horrific things that they did to the native populations here. But I'm a product of that, And my food and my history and my culture and my heritage are all informed by people trying to retain traditions and people being exposed and being forced into new traditions. And that's me, to honor both sides of that. Not to say both people or both sides have good things, but the truth of that is my food is this incredible demonstration of different cultures influencing the materials and the ingredients that we have here, you know, in the Americas. The influence to religion, the influence to art, to architecture, to history, all of those things coming together because of some terrible atrocities, but then also a perseverance and this desire to survive and tell stories. Genetically, and I'm a quarter Native American. I can actually pinpoint some of the pueblos that my family likely came from in distant history. And you go to New Mexico, and there is a completely different flavor of regional cuisine that is heavily influenced by the Native populations that are still there. You know, you go to like you go to some kind of festival, or you go to some kind of fair, and we have like fry bread tacos that are completely different than what you would find anywhere else in the world. And it's all because of this melting pot of influences that all kind of come together. So sorry, that, you know, for talking about horror films and knowing what today is, that question just kind of sparked Ken Hox. There's a lot to dig into there. From Barry Johnson, we could be here for another hour, but Thanksgiving will do. Oh, baseball super, you mean the lasagna side of your family? I'm telling you, man, when you start mixing those flavors, if any of you have seen it, there's the documentary, little documentary series on Netflix that I absolutely adore, the Taco Chronicles, where each taco narrates its own existence, you know, like where I came from and how you prepare me and what are the ingredients that make me authentic. And it's so delightful. It really is. It's adorable. I love the narrators that they pick for each individual taco. And like, I've learned a little, like I'm going to be trying to do a different take on a carnitas with a little bit more citrus and a little bit more orange. And you're like, oh, I'd never considered that. My family comes from Michoacan, but then here's this other influence that came from the south of Mexico. And then if we're on the west coast, that's a completely different slate of ingredients. And like, oh, I love this. It's like so much story for something that is going to take me days to make and is going to be shoved into my face in a matter of minutes. I want that so bad. So, from Destador. Oh, you know, that's a great pick. There's this movie. So Destador writes, what about the ABCs of death? There was a pretty cool dude in that holding a boom mic as a sound guy. You know, I feel like that was the most pivotal character in the most important short story in the ABCs of death. So, yeah, you could probably check that out. You know what? If I remember correctly, it's if you want to skip, because they go, that's a short story for every letter of the alphabet. But I feel like the most critical is Q. So in ABCs of Death, Q is for quack. If you catch that one, I think you'll really get a sense of like what short form horror film making is all about. That one was written and directed by Adam Wingard. Who's gone on to make really, really big, high-profile, big blockbuster films. So, you know, you're really seeing an amazing example of shoestring budget horror filmmaking. From Aditya Nail, seeing Juan get excited is legit putting a smile on my face. I needed that too. But we should probably start wrapping this up. My voice is held out. I'm so excited that I didn't totally fail like I thought I was going to. Right on time, 2.5 hours, right? That's kind of how long my podcasts go. Literally, Gadget Guy 2020 just said that. Oh, that's hilarious. 2 hours, 30 minutes. I'm on time. All right, let's go ahead and shut this down. So much stuff is coming out. The Vivo camera deep dive. I'm going to be playing with a bunch of audio gear, some great earbuds, those Beyerdynamic headphones. I'm going to start digging into a little bit more some of the camera and support hardware, talking about ND filters and cages and ways to get a bit more use out of our smartphone cameras. I've got some wearables, some fitness tracking. I've got phones to properly finish reviewing. It's going to be some really solid stuff, and I'm feeling a bit more animated. So thanks for jumping in on this, because I've been off and on, like, feeling great and then feeling crappy and then feeling great and then feeling crappy. And so now I'm energized. I'm ready to start my week here. But also just to start it off, and I want to kind of explore, I'm going to maybe put together a list of the horror films that my family, that we watch. And I would love to kind of revisit this, especially as we get a little closer to Halloween proper. You know, we've got Pixel coming out next week, but it's not, the official announcement's going to be the day after my podcast. So I don't want to do another just round of here's the speculation and oh, Brandon leaked some more stuff. I want to find some other things to kind of dig into. We'll have some other phones to talk about. We'll have some other gear to compare, and then just find a little bit more fun for some of the media and stuff. So if you catch any movies, if there's maybe an indie on like Amazon that no one's watching right now, let me know. And I want to make this kind of like the little cap to some of our podcasts for the next couple weeks. As we get into the holiday films of Halloween, and then we can also maybe kind of dovetail this into the holiday films of Thanksgiving and Christmas too. So, folks, I want everybody to have an amazing week. Thank you so much for joining. I needed this. I always feel incomplete when I don't get to start my week with this podcast. So last week felt off for how I normally structure my week. Being sick sucks. And especially being sick in the time of COVID, you know, there was a lot of anxiousness. I did 2 tests, both came up negative. It's just a head cold, exacerbated by some allergies. This is how I refuel my mental energy tanks. So thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for participating, all these wonderful comments, other topics that we want to talk about. And if this podcast needs to become, you know, film, TV, video games, and food, we can add those topics too. I'm game, obviously. So everyone have a fantastic week. Thank you so much. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you all back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Be well. Take care. Take care of yourselves. Take care of yourselves first, and then also with some of that energy left over, take care of your friends, your family, your neighbors. We've all got to look out for each other still, and I hope you're all eating some really good food while you're doing it. I'll catch you back. I love y'all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.